Chapter 12. Mother of All Wars, the 2012 Setback. On a soft, summery night in Beaver Creek, Colorado, at the end of June 2011, the Kochs mustered their troops once again for what Charles described as the Mother of All Wars. The phrase, borrowed from the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, hinted at the level of martial ferocity with which the billionaire brothers planned to approach the coming 2012 presidential campaign. It would be the first presidential race after the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. For those with the requisite financial resources, political spending was now as limitless as the open sky above the Bachelor Gulch Ritz-Carlton. 300 or so participants were there for the semi-annual seminar, whose theme was Understanding and Addressing Threats to American Free Enterprise and Prosperity. This time, the planners took extra precautions to keep the proceedings secret. A series of loudspeakers formed a fence around an outdoor pavilion in which the donors met, emitting static toward the outside world to prevent eavesdropping. Or so they thought, until a reporter for Mother Jones, Brad Friedman, obtained an audio recording of the weekend's highlights and published a transcript. As they gathered in the foothills of the Rockies, the donors had ample reason for optimism. The New York Times' resident number cruncher Nate Silver, who handicapped political odds with the unsentimental eye of a racetrack bookie, was openly asking, "Is Obama toast?" After analyzing Obama's sagging approval rating and the economy's lagging indicators, he concluded that Obama had gone from a modest favorite to win re-election to probably a slight underdog. If the Republicans chose a weak candidate or the economy miraculously revived, he noted, this could change. But if the challengers played it right, he predicted, Obama would go the way of the recent re-election losers Jimmy Carter and George H.W. Bush. The choice of a strong Republican candidate, however, 15 months before the next presidential election, was far from assured. Behind the scenes, Sean Noble, with the assent of the Kochs, had been furtively trying for months to persuade Paul Ryan to run for the White House. The billionaire backers were eager for him to apply his sharp knives to the federal budget. But Ryan had demurred. Neither he nor his wife relished a presidential marathon. "Wouldn't it be easier just to be picked as vice president?" he asked an emissary from the Kochs in a meeting in the congressman's Washington office. "Because then it's only like 2 months." With Ryan declining to run, the Kochs and their operatives searched anxiously for an alternative. Mitt Romney was obviously a serious contender, but they worried that he couldn't relate well enough to ordinary people to get elected. Polls showed that Romney, who had made a fortune in finance before his stint as governor of Massachusetts, fared dismally when voters were asked if he cares about people like you. The search for a more promising candidate set off a torrid courtship of Chris Christie, the tough guy governor of New Jersey. David Koch invited Christie to his Manhattan office, where the two spent almost 2 hours bonding over Christie's brawls with the unions and other liberal forces. The governor's scrappy blue-collar style, combined with his plutocrat-friendly economic policies, made him an almost irresistible prospect. By June, the Kochs had given Christie the keynote speaker slot at their seminar, where he could audition for his party's leading role in front of the people who could pay his way. Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, who preceded Christie as a speaker, provided a perfect foil. In a prelude to Perry's later oops moment during the Republican debates, the governor made a poor impression on the numerically minded businessmen in the audience by displaying five fingers to illustrate a four-point plan, only to be left with one digit still waving in the air, programmatically unaccounted for. In comparison, Christie was the political equivalent of his idol, Bruce Springsteen. David Koch personally introduced him, showering him with praise as not just a true political hero who tells it like it is, but also my kind of guy. Koch was especially effusive about the courage and leadership Christie showed in forging a bipartisan deal to cut future pension and benefit payments to New Jersey's unionized public sector employees. In exchange for these concessions, the Democrats and their union allies had obtained a promise from Christie to increase payments into the ailing funds. This tough-minded seeming fix vaulted Christie to national prominence. 4 years later, a judge would rule that it was more like a bait and switch. The workers' benefits were cut, but the state, which was in an economic slump, reneged on its end of the bargain. In 2011, however, for the Kochs and their assembled allies, Christie was the cherished face of the future. Who knows? Koch teased, as the donors cheered, whistled, and hooted their approval during his introduction. With his enormous success in reforming New Jersey, someday we might see him on a larger stage where, God knows, he is desperately needed. Christie soon brought the well-heeled crowd to its feet by casting low taxes on high-income earners as a populist cause. In a bravura performance, he described going to battle against what he called a millionaire's tax, a 1% income tax increase on the state's top earners. "Take this back where it came from, 'cause I ain't signing it," he recounted telling the Democrats as the donors cheered. Christie had campaigned on making his state a superpower in wind energy, but his reversal and withdrawal from a regional program to reduce greenhouse gas emissions also drew cheers. When it came time for questions from the audience, the first speaker voiced the excitement in the room, saying, "You're the first guy I've seen who I know could beat Barack Obama," and then, amid laughter and applause, begged Christie to run. But the dinner's main course was the fundraising session led by Charles Koch. In a folksy Midwestern voice, he appealed for contributions, as if America's survival depended on it. After invoking Saddam Hussein's famous battle cry from the first Gulf War, Koch struck a more alarmist note. The stakes in the coming presidential campaign, he warned, were nothing short of the life or death of this country. Not, he added with good humor, that he was trying to put any pressure on anyone here, mind you. This is not pressure. But if this makes your heart feel glad and you want to be more forthcoming, so be it. Then, in a move guaranteed to put the squeeze on everyone else, he publicly identified and commended the largest donors to date. "What I want to do is recognize not all our great partners, but those partners who have given more than $1 billion. A mil? No, billion." At which point he caught and corrected himself. As the wealthy crowd knowingly guffawed at the easy confusion over a few extra zeros, Charles ad-libbed, "Well, I was thinking of Obama and his billion-dollar campaign, so I thought we gotta do better than that." He went on, "If you want to kick in $1 billion, believe me, we'll have a special seminar just for you." Charles then ticked off the names of the 32 donors who had contributed $1 million or more during the previous 12 months. 9 were billionaires whose fortunes had landed them on Forbes' list of the 400 wealthiest Americans. Some, like the finance stars Charles Schwab, Ken Griffin, and Paul Singer, as well as Amway's Richard DeVos and the natural gas entrepreneur Harold Hamm, were fairly well known. Many others, though, were members of the invisible rich, owners of enormously profitable private enterprises that rarely drew public attention. 2 among the 9 billionaires, for instance, John Menard Jr., whose fortune Forbes estimated at $6 billion, and Diane Hendricks, whose fortune the magazine valued at $2.9 billion, owned private building and home supply companies in Wisconsin and were not well known outside the state, let alone in it. Many of the non-billionaires whom Charles recognized were familiar faces in the Koch circle. There were the Popes from North Carolina, the Freeze family from Wyoming, and the Robertsons of the Texas oil clan, as well as coal barons like Joe Kraft and the Gilliams, and members of the Marshall family, the only significant outside owners of Koch Industries stock. Charles then added, 10 more will remain anonymous, including David and me, so we're very humble in that," he joked. More seriously, though, he declared that, "The plan is, the next seminar, I'm going to read the names of the 10 million, not mere $1 million donors." As he read the names of the generous, he made clear what he expected their money to buy. He promised those he referred to as his partners that we are absolutely going to do our utmost to invest this money wisely and get the best possible payoff for you in the future of the country. None of these thoughts were shared with the rest of the country. Far from the Supreme Court majority's assumption in the Citizens United case that political spending would be transparent, the Kochs and their partners took great pains to hide what they were up to. Indeed, this was a selling point. Kevin Gentry, vice president of Koch Industries for Special Projects, who had overseen fundraising for the brothers for years and who played the role of master of ceremonies at the seminars, assured the donors that weekend, "There is anonymity we can protect." The Kochs had recently come up with a new and even cleverer way of masking the money. Rather than simply directing the funds through the maze of secretive nonprofit charities and social welfare groups that they had used during the 2010 campaign, they now established a more efficient method. They pooled much of the cash first in a form of nonprofit corporation that the tax code defined as a 501c6, or a business league. The advantage of this umbrella organization, which they named the Association for American Innovation, AAI, was that donations to it could be classified as membership dues, and to some extent get deducted as business expenses. As with contributions to a 501c4, the law protected the donor's anonymity. But as a business league, it fell outside the charitable trust purview of state attorneys general, further safeguarding the secrecy. By the time the Beaver Creek seminar adjourned, the Kochs had collected some $70 million in new pledges. There was no public record showing specifically how these new funds were spent, but it appears that much of the money was directed into the new business league, the Association for American Innovation. During 2011 alone, tax records show, the AAI, which soon changed its name to Freedom Partners, accumulated over $250 million. The new business league, which was at first run by Wayne Gable, the head of lobbying for Koch Industries, was less than candid with the Internal Revenue Service about its intentions. According to its founding documents, it told the IRS it does not currently plan to attempt to influence any election, and in the future might do so, but only to an insubstantial extent. From the start, however, the organization financed many of the same political front groups that the Kochs had mobilized in the 2010 midterms. This time, though, their underground guerrilla war against Obama was waged by a business league and treated as a partially tax-deductible business expense. From November 2011 to October 2012, the Kochs' new business league transferred $115 million to Sean Noble's Center to Protect Patient Rights and $32.3 million to David Koch's group, Americans for Prosperity. In October 2011, Christie announced definitively that 2012 was not his year. The truism about the two parties was that when it came to choosing candidates, Democrats fall in love, while Republicans fall in line. But 2012 was shaping up to be the exception, with power shifting from the centralized party professionals to rogue billionaires, top-down consensus was giving way to warring factions. Even within the Koch camp, there were divergent opinions. After the infatuation with Ryan, David Koch liked Christie. Charles Koch admired Mike Pence, then a congressman and later governor of Indiana. When Pence declined to get in the race, the Kochs hired his former chief of staff, Mark Short, as yet another political advisor. The donors, meanwhile, were all over the Republican lot. Noble was trying hard to herd everyone in one direction, but failing. Unsure what else to do, in late 2011, the Koch operatives made one of the first attack ads of the general election season. Sponsored by Americans for Prosperity, it slammed Obama as corruptly showering his friends with green giveaways, such as Solyndra. AFP spent $2.4 million running the ad thousands of times in the key states of Florida, Michigan, Nevada, and Virginia. Sean Noble had sold the idea as a clean shot. But it caused a little problem. One of the Koch donors turned out to have invested in Solyndra and was not happy. A subsequent Koch-created ad, aired by the American Future Fund, also proved problematic. The mysterious Iowa-based front group was a favorite choice for messages from which the Koch camp preferred to distance itself. Shot as populist rage against the 1% was coalescing in the Occupy movement and protesters were marching on David Koch's apartment, the ad slyly attacked Obama for being too cozy with Wall Street. After quoting Obama calling Wall Street bankers fat cats, it asked, "Guess who voted for the Wall Street bailout? His White House is full of Wall Street executives," it went on, as mug shots of Obama's advisors flashed by. The Koch's political operatives tested the ad in 15 separate focus groups. Once aired, it seemed to be a great success, getting over 5 million hits on YouTube. But some of the finance industry executives in the donor group were not amused by the political misdirection. "Why attack Wall Street?" they asked. One donor, Peter Schiff, an attendee at the June Koch seminar, evidently didn't receive the new populist talking points. A Connecticut financial analyst and broker, he barged into the midst of the Occupy movement's Manhattan encampment in October with a sign proclaiming, "I am the 1%. Let's talk." Subsequent video footage of him arguing in favor of eliminating the minimum wage and paying mentally retarded people $2 an hour made him a laughingstock on Jon Stewart's Daily Show. The Koch's mother of all wars wasn't starting out all that much better than Saddam Hussein's. The picture was far brighter in the key presidential battleground state of Wisconsin. There, the first-term governor, Scott Walker, had vaulted to national stardom by enacting unexpectedly bold anti-union policies. Walker exemplified the new generation of Republicans who had coasted to victory in 2010 on a wave of dark money, ready to implement policies their backers had painstakingly incubated in conservative nonprofits for decades. For the Koch network, Walker's improbable rise was a triumph. Koch Industries PAC was the second largest contributor to Walker's campaign. More important, the Kochs were an important source of funds to the Republican Governors Association, which Republicans used in Wisconsin and elsewhere in 2010 to work around strict state contribution limits. The Kochs PAC had also contributed to 16 state legislative candidates in Wisconsin who all won their races, helping conservatives take control of both houses of the legislature and setting the stage for Wisconsin's dramatic turn to the right. Walker had also benefited enormously from the philanthropy of two other arch-conservative brothers, the late Lind and Harry Bradley, whose foundation had grown into an ideological behemoth in Milwaukee. Walker's campaign manager, Michael Grebe, was the Bradley Foundation's president. Think tanks had long supplied policy ideas to those in power. Some, like the Liberal Center for American Progress, were led by well-known partisans who moved in and out of government. It was rare, though, to wear both hats simultaneously, but Grebe's dual role would have made his predecessor at the Bradley Foundation, Michael Joyce, proud. It was exactly the kind of hands-on political impact Joyce had sought when he set out to weaponize conservative philanthropy. The Bradley Foundation's close ties to Walker were evident on his social calendar. Among his first private engagements after the election was a celebratory dinner with the foundation's board and senior staff at Bacchus, a stylish Milwaukee restaurant overlooking Lake Michigan. By then, Lind and Harry Bradley's foundation had assets of over $612 million and had provided the playbook for many of Walker's policies. Grebe denied his foundation had hatched the initiative that made Walker famous, his crackdown on the state employees' unions, but he applauded the move and had personally sent out fundraising letters asking supporters to help Walker fight the big government union bosses. The Bradley Foundation, meanwhile, in 2009, gave huge grants to two conservative Wisconsin think tanks developing plans to break the power of the state's public employee unions. As the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel noted in 2011, the Bradley Foundation was one of the most powerful philanthropic forces behind America's conservative movement, and the financial backer behind public policy experiments that started in the state and spread across the nation, including welfare reform, public vouchers for private schools, and, this year, cutbacks in public employee benefits and collective bargaining. As Grebe later acknowledged about Walker's meteoric rise to the New York Times, at the risk of being immodest, I probably lent some credibility to his campaign early on. As a college dropout with no exceptional charisma or charm, Walker might not ordinarily have been marked for high office, but Americans for Prosperity, which had a large chapter in Wisconsin, had provided him with a field operation and speaking platform at its Tea Party rallies when he was still just the Milwaukee County Executive. The Koch's political organization had been fighting the state's powerful public employee unions there since 2007. The fight was freighted with larger significance. In 1959, Wisconsin had become the first state to allow its public employees to form unions and engage in collective bargaining, which conservatives detested in part because the unions provided a big chunk of muscle to the Democratic Party. "We go back a long way on this in Wisconsin and in other states," Tim Phillips, the head of Americans for Prosperity, acknowledged to Politico. In the past, Phillips had spoken enviously of the unions as the left's army on the ground. Walker's anti-union, anti-tax, and small government message harmonized perfectly with the Koch's philosophy and also served their business interests. Koch Industries had two Georgia Pacific paper mills in the state, as well as interests in lumber mills, coal, and pipelines employing some 3,000 workers. Soon, a handful of Wisconsin's wealthiest magnates, who were part of the Koch donor network, started writing checks too. John Menard Jr., for instance, the richest man in Wisconsin, was both a $1 million donor at the Koch's June 2011 summit and $1.5 million donor to the Wisconsin Club for Growth, an outside dark money group boosting Walker. Like many of Menard's investments, the political contributions more than paid off. Once in office, Walker chaired a state economic development corporation that bestowed $1.8 million in special tax credits on Menard's business. Walker's administration also eased up on enforcement actions against polluters. 70 years old at the time Walker was elected, Menard had made a fortune, estimated at about $6 billion in 2010, from a chain of home improvement stores bearing his name. But until Walker entered the State House, his relationship with the government had been contentious, to say the least. According to a 2007 profile in Milwaukee Magazine, his company had more clashes with the state's Department of Natural Resources than any other firm in Wisconsin. Ultimately, his company, and Menard personally, paid $1.7 million in fines for illegally disposing of hazardous waste. In one memorable instance, his company reportedly labeled arsenic-tainted mulch as ideal for playgrounds. Menard's hostility to organized labor was pronounced. He imposed an absolute ban on hiring anyone who had ever belonged to a union. One employee described having to fire two promising management prospects because they had worked in high school as baggers for a unionized supermarket. Managers, meanwhile, were subject to 60% pay cuts if their stores became unionized. They also had to agree to pay fines of $100 per minute for infractions such as opening late and to submit any disputes to management-friendly arbitration rather than the courts. Menard also forbade employees to build their own houses for fear they would pilfer supplies. When one employee got special permission to build a ramp-equipped home in order to accommodate a wheelchair-bound daughter in exchange for a demotion and a large salary cut, he was fired. His offense was that his contractor was using building materials from a competitor. Menard had a disputatious record on compensation and taxes as well. The IRS ordered him to pay $6 million in back taxes after he allegedly mischaracterized $20 million as salary, not dividends, deducting it as a business expense. In a separate case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court forced Menard to pay $1.6 million to a former legal counsel, a woman who was the sister of his girlfriend at the time, to compensate for gender discrimination and gross underpayment. The woman's lawyer described Menard as a man without parameters, no limits, no respect for the law, and obviously no self-discipline. That case was followed by another in which the wife of a former business associate, whom Menard fired in 2011, accused him of retaliating against her husband because of her refusal to engage in a sexual threesome with the billionaire and his wife. A spokesman for Menard denied the allegation. Meanwhile, a second woman, the wife of a former Indianapolis Colts quarterback, claimed Menard fired her for rebuffing his sexual advances. The company spokesman denied this as well. All in all, Menard seemed an unlikely patron for Walker, who emphasized his Christian conservatism as the son of a Baptist preacher, but on economic policies, there was a meeting of the minds. Moreover, Menard was famously press-shy, and little of his involvement with Walker surfaced until years later. Diane Hendricks, the richest woman in Wisconsin and another of the Koch's million-dollar donors, might also have stayed beneath the radar, except for a documentary filmmaker who fortuitously caught her on camera. 15 days after Walker was inaugurated, in January 2011, Hendricks was captured in what she thought was a private chat, urging the governor to go after the unions. Looking glamorous but impatient, the 60-something widow pressed Walker to turn Wisconsin into a completely red, right-to-work state. Walker assured her that he had a plan. He had kept voters in the dark about it during his campaign, but he confided to Hendricks that his first step was to deal with collective bargaining for all public employees' unions. This, he assured her, would divide and conquer the labor movement. Evidently, this was what Hendricks wanted to hear. She had amassed a fortune estimated at $3.6 billion from ABC Supply, the nation's largest wholesale distributor of roofing, windows, and siding, which she and her late husband Ken founded in 1982. Despite her phenomenal success, Hendricks said she was worried that America was becoming a socialist ideological nation. Soon after the governor reassured her that he shared her concern, Hendricks and her company began a series of record-setting contributions that would reportedly make her Walker's biggest financial backer. When Walker dropped the bomb on the unions, as he put it, he effectively stripped most state employees of the right to bargain collectively on their pay packages. He singled out the public employees, and particularly teachers, whose average salary was $51,264, as causes of the state's deficit. Amid the doomsday talk about overindulged and under-contributing public workers who were bankrupting the state, one awkward fact went unmentioned. Thanks to complicated accounting maneuvers, Diane Hendricks, according to state records, did not pay a dime in personal state income taxes in 2010. Lines were drawn in Madison in a desperate attempt to deprive Republicans of the quorum necessary to pass Walker's anti-union bill. Democratic legislators fled the state. Angry activists stormed the legislature, thronged the streets, and lambasted Walker as the Koch's anti-union stooge. Walker unwittingly lent credence to the caricature less than a month into his tenure by carrying on a long, cringeworthy phone conversation with a prankster pretending to be David Koch, the contents of which were soon made public. In a phrase that said all too much, Walker enthusiastically signed off with the imposter by saying, "Thanks a million." As the furious backlash against Walker evolved into a prolonged and ultimately unsuccessful effort by his critics to recall him from office, the Kochs, who by then had become the face of the opposition, mounted a fierce counterattack. They used Americans for Prosperity and other vehicles to mobilize pro-Walker rallies and air thousands of Stand with Walker and It's Working television and radio ads. They also utilized Themis, a high-tech data bank they had developed to help get out the vote. After Walker triumphed in the recall fight, putting him in line for his ill-fated run for the White House in 2016, an independent counsel's investigation into possible campaign finance violations disgorged a trove of emails revealing just how many hugely wealthy, out-of-state hidden hands were involved in his campaign to stay in office. The emails revealed advisors to Walker scheming to get the Kochs and allied donors to help him by donating to what purported to be an independent group, the Wisconsin Club for Growth. One email suggested, take Koch's money. Another insisted that the governor should get on a plane to Vegas and sit down with Sheldon Adelson. It went on, ask for $1 million now. A third advised Walker that Paul Singer, the hedge fund mogul, would be at the same resort as he, and insisted, grab him. Soon after, the Wisconsin Club for Growth received $250,000 from Singer. At the helm of the Wisconsin Club for Growth, and thus at the center of the web, was an old ally of the Kochs, Eric O'Keefe. He was the same Wisconsin investor who had volunteered in David Koch's ill-fated libertarian campaign for vice president before going on to run the Sam Adams Alliance, which had played a seminal role in launching the Tea Party movement, and joined the Cato Institute's board. Over the years, O'Keefe's various political gambits had also been greatly aided by the Bradley Foundation. According to one tally, it contributed over $3 million to groups directed or founded by O'Keefe between 1998 and 2012. The Bradley Foundation, meanwhile, tightened its ties to several members of the Koch circle. It soon added to its board both Diane Hendricks and Art Pope, the Koch's longtime North Carolina ally, who also was on the board of Americans for Prosperity. The club that O'Keefe and the others belonged to was ingrown and small, but its reach was growing. Richard Fink made clear what the stakes were for both himself and his benefactors after the embarrassment of the trick phone call. "We will not step back at all," he proclaimed, "with the left trying to intimidate the Koch brothers to back off of their support for freedom and signaling to others that this is what happens if you oppose the administration and its allies. We have no choice but to continue the fight." Fink defiantly claimed, "This is a big part of our life's work. We are not going to stop." Buoyed by their success in Wisconsin, the Kochs began to focus in earnest on the presidential race. It had taken years, but by 2012 they were becoming a rival center of power to the Republican establishment. Political insiders who had once scoffed at them now marveled at the breadth of their political operation. While amassing one of the most lucrative fortunes in the world, the Kochs had also created an ideological assembly line justifying it. Now they had added a powerful political machine to protect it. They had hired top-level operatives, financed their own voter data bank, commissioned state-of-the-art polling, and created a fundraising operation that enlisted hundreds of other wealthy Americans to help pay for it. They had also forged a coalition of some 17 allied conservative groups with niche constituencies who would mask their centralized source of funding and carry their message. To mobilize Latino voters, they formed a group called the Libre Initiative. To reach conservative women, they funded Concerned Women for America. For millennials, they formed Generation Opportunity. To cover up fingerprints on television attack ads, they hid behind the American Future Fund and other front groups. Their network's money also flowed to gun groups, retirees, veterans, anti-labor groups, anti-tax groups, evangelical Christian groups, and even $4.5 million for something called the Center for Shared Services, which coordinated administrative tasks such as office space rentals and paperwork for the others. Americans for Prosperity, meanwhile, organized chapters all across the country. The Kochs had established what was, in effect, their own private political party. Secrecy permeated every level of the operation. One former Koch executive, Ben Pratt, who became the chief operating officer of the voter data bank Themis, used a quotation from Salvador Dali on his personal blog that could have served as the enterprise's motto, "The secret of my influence is that it has always remained secret." Robert Tappan, a spokesman for Koch Industries, defended the secrecy as a matter of security because Koch has been targeted repeatedly in the past by the administration and its allies because of our real, or in some cases, perceived beliefs and activities concerning public policy and political issues, overlooking decades of secrecy from the John Birch Society onward. This consolidation of power reflected the overall national trend of increasingly large and concentrated campaign spending by the ultra-wealthy in the post-Citizens United era. The spending, in turn, was a reflection of the growing concentration of wealth more generally in America. As a result, the 2012 election was a tipping point of sorts. Not only was it by far the most expensive election in the country's history, it was also the first time since the advent of modern campaign finance laws when outside spending groups, including super PACs and tax-exempt nonprofit groups, flush with unlimited contributions from the country's richest donors, spent more than $1 billion to influence federal elections. And when the spending on attack ads run by nonprofits was factored in, outside spending groups might well have outspent the campaigns and the political parties for the first time. The Koch network loomed as a colossus over this new political landscape. On the right, there were other formidable donor networks, including the one assembled by Karl Rove, but no single outside group spent as much. On its own, in 2012, the Koch's network of a few hundred individuals spent at least $407 million, almost all of it anonymously. This was more than John McCain spent on his entire 2008 presidential bid, and it was more than the combined contributions to the two presidential campaigns made by 5,667,658 Americans, whose donations were legally capped at $5,000. Politico's Kenneth Vogel crunched the numbers and discovered that in the presidential race, the top 0.04% of donors contributed about the same amount as the bottom 68%. No previous year for which there was data had shown more spending by fewer people. The staggeringly lopsided situation made 2012 the starkest test yet of Louis Brandeis's dictum that the country could have either democracy or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but not both. The Koch's growing clout was evident in a confidential internal Romney campaign memo dated October 4, 2011. Romney, like virtually every ambitious Republican in the country, was angling for David Koch's support. The memo described him plainly as the financial engine of the Tea Party, although it noted that he denies being directly involved. Romney, it revealed, had hoped to woo Koch in a private tête-à-tête at the billionaire's beachfront mansion in Southampton, New York, over the summer. But to the campaign's dismay, Hurricane Irene had washed the meeting out. With the Iowa caucuses looming and Chris Christie out of the race, Romney tried again in the fall. Shortly after the memo was written, Romney took two controversial campaign stances that were guaranteed to please the billionaire brothers. First, he reversed his earlier position on climate change. In his 2010 book, No Apology, Romney had written, "I believe that climate change is occurring. The reduction in the size of global ice caps is hard to ignore. I also believe that human activity is a contributing factor." When he hit the campaign trail in June of 2011, Romney reiterated this view and stressed that it was important for us to reduce our emissions of pollutants and greenhouse gases that may well be significant contributors to the climate change and the global warming that you're seeing. But at a rally in Manchester, New Hampshire, in late October, he suddenly declared himself a climate change skeptic. "My view is that we don't know what's causing climate change on this planet," he said, "and the idea of spending trillions and trillions of dollars to try to reduce CO2 emissions is not the right course for us," he declared. By the time he accepted the Republican nomination in Tampa the following summer, Romney treated the notion of acting on climate change as a joke. "President Obama promised to begin to slow the rise of the oceans and to heal the planet," he mocked. "My promise is to help you and your family." A week after first reversing himself on climate change, Romney skipped a campaign event attended by every other Republican presidential candidate in Iowa in order to speak at Americans for Prosperity's annual Defending the American Dream Summit in Washington. There, he delivered a keynote address that could have passed as an audition for David Koch, who was in the audience. Romney had governed Massachusetts as a Northeastern moderate, but now he unveiled a budget plan reminiscent of Paul Ryan's. Soon afterward, Romney proposed to cut all income tax rates by one-fifth. According to the nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, Romney's proposal would save those in the top 0.1% an average of $264,000 a year, and the poorest 20% of taxpayers an average of $78. The middle class would get on average $791. Romney also proposed other items high on his donors' wish lists, including eliminating estate taxes, lowering the corporate tax rate, and ending taxes owed by companies that had shipped operations overseas. Taken as a whole, the Tax Policy Center said the proposal would add $5 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. Romney said he would make up the difference by closing unspecified tax loopholes. Charles Koch often described his support for slashing taxes as motivated by a concern for the poor. They are the ones that suffer from bigger government, he argued in an interview with his hometown paper. Yet there was no getting around the fact that the numbers added up to a disproportionately huge gift to the already rich. These guys all talk about the deficit, but there's not a single tax benefit for the wealthy they'll get rid of, Dan Pfeiffer, Obama's former communications advisor, later pointed out. What really made them furious, he said, was when we started talking about closing the loopholes for private jets. If these policy shifts were designed in part to win the Koch's support, they succeeded. By July, David Koch not only embraced Romney, but threw a $75,000 per couple fundraiser for him at his Southampton estate. Romney and Koch were described as exuding a confident glow as they and their wives descended the stairs following a private half-hour chat before the other guests arrived. A few weeks later, Romney chose Ryan as his running mate. The pick was opposed by Romney's campaign consultant, Stuart Stevens, and proved baffling to Obama because of the unpopularity of Ryan's extreme budget plan. But conservative donors, including David Koch and his wife Julia, had lobbied for Ryan. It was one more indication that an invisible wealth primary was shaping the discourse and the field long before the rest of the country had the chance to vote. With two of the largest fortunes in the world at their disposal, together worth an estimated $62 billion by 2012, Charles and David Koch were perfectly positioned to take advantage of the growing importance of money in American politics. Yet the presidential campaign still proved difficult for them to manage, with the eclipse of the party professionals by outside funders. Virtually any novice with enough cash, including other donors in their own circle, could now disrupt the process. As the presidential race began, Sean Noble was arguing to anyone in the Koch fold who would listen that it was time to pull the trigger on Newt Gingrich. The former Speaker of the House from Georgia had reinvented himself as a long-shot Republican presidential candidate. Even some of the conservatives who had been part of Gingrich's revolution in the House in the 1990s were privately begging the Koch operatives to act before Gingrich did irreparable damage to the other Republican candidates and the party. Gingrich was a brilliant force of entropy, dazzlingly eloquent on some occasions, utterly daft on others, and ruthlessly destructive to anyone in his path. For him, politics was total war, and he had the scars to prove it. In preparation, Noble's firm quietly produced what it hoped was a lethal television ad, using footage from a 2008 ad showing Gingrich sitting on a dainty love seat with Nancy Pelosi, agreeing that they needed to fight global warming. On the Republican side, it would have proved pure poison, but Noble couldn't get authorization to air it. The hesitation appeared related to the addition of Sheldon Adelson, the enormously wealthy casino mogul, to the Koch circle. Sheldon Adelson, whom President George W. Bush once reportedly described as "this crazy Jewish billionaire yelling at me," wasn't exactly the Koch's type. He was a hard-right foreign policy hawk who was focused on ensuring the security of Israel. He had been a Democrat, but he shared the Koch's antipathy toward labor unions, Obama, and redistributive income taxes. "Why is it fair that I should be paying a higher percentage of taxes than anyone else?" he once complained. Perhaps more important, with a fortune estimated in 2011 at $23.3 billion, the 78-year-old chairman of the Las Vegas Sands Corporation brought a lot of chips to the table. He could potentially increase the power of the Koch donor network exponentially. The Kochs had repeatedly invited Adelson to join their group, but gotten nowhere. So when he finally showed up for the first time at their January 2012 summit in Indian Wells, California, they were not eager to trash his favorite candidate, who happened to be Gingrich. "There were a lot of them who were pretty unhappy with Sheldon," a Koch confidant says, "but Newt pushed all his buttons." The odd couple had been friends for decades, bonding in the 1990s when Gingrich helped Adelson prevail in a bitter war to keep his casino operation, unlike the others in Las Vegas, union-free. They also shared a deep commitment to Israel's hardline conservatives, especially its Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, with whom, an associate says, Adelson often spoke several times a week. Adelson had lavished millions of dollars on Gingrich during his precipitous ups and downs. Calling himself just a loyal guy, Adelson continued that support after Gingrich was forced to resign from office in 1999 amid ethics charges and an insurrection within his own ranks. Long after the center of political gravity had shifted elsewhere, Adelson continued to loan Gingrich his private jets and contributed nearly $8 million to the nest of ventures that kept Gingrich employed. But there was one touchy Israel-related issue on which the old friends disagreed. Adelson had long sought clemency for Jonathan Pollard, the Jewish-American spy convicted of passing state secrets to Israel, who was serving a life sentence in federal prison. In the past, Gingrich had called Pollard one of the most notorious traitors in U.S. history and scuttled a Clinton-era deal to release him. If freed, Gingrich warned, Pollard might resume his treacherous conduct and further damage the national security of the United States. But in December 2011, as Gingrich was heading into the Iowa caucuses in desperate need of cash, he switched his position. In an interview with the Jewish Channel, he announced that he now had a bias in favor of clemency for Pollard. Within weeks, Adelson donated $5 million to Gingrich's sputtering campaign, which otherwise, in all likelihood, would have fizzled out. Adelson's cash temporarily revived Gingrich, unleashing a chain of unintended consequences. The pro-Gingrich super PAC used the casino magnate's money to purchase more than $3 million in advertising time in South Carolina. Then it aired a half-hour video called King of Bane when Mitt Romney came to town that eviscerated Romney as a greedy, predatory corporate raider. After the video was attacked, Gingrich called on the super PAC to take it down, but not before he amplified the message by denouncing Bain Capital, the private equity company that Romney had co-founded, as rich people figuring out clever ways to loot a company. No left-winger could have made the case against high finance more convincingly. Romney became the face of vulture capitalism, which was depicted as heartlessly cannibalizing what was left of the country's middle class. When Gingrich was finished with Bain, he went on to demand that Romney release his tax returns. As Noble had feared, the consequences of Gingrich at full throttle were disastrous for the Republicans. Gingrich's attack on capitalist excess was underwritten by one of the richest men in the world, whose international gambling empire was at that moment under federal criminal investigation for laundering money and foreign corrupt practices. Eventually, according to court testimony, Adelson's company paid a $47 million out-of-court settlement in the money laundering case for failing to report a $45 million transfer of cash it made on behalf of a Chinese-Mexican businessman who was under investigation for drug trafficking. In another case, Adelson's former chief executive officer accused the mogul's subsidiary in Macau of consorting with organized crime figures and making excessive payments to a local official that might breach laws prohibiting U.S. citizens from engaging in corrupt practices overseas. Adelson described the allegations as delusional and fabricated, but the legal cloud did little to enhance the image of the Koch network or the GOP. Instead of shoring up the Republican ticket, big money tainted the brand, prolonged the primaries, pushed the candidates to adopt their donors' pet issues, and, all in all, did the Democrats work for them. Romney did nothing to mitigate the Richie Rich caricature, after insisting that corporations are people and saying, "I like being able to fire people," he revealed details of a $250 million blind trust crammed with offshore investments in tax havens, ranging from Switzerland to the Cayman Islands. His description of the $374,000 he made in speaking fees in 2010 as "not very much" sealed his image as hopelessly out of touch with ordinary Americans. The snapshot showing how the 1% lived became more toxic still when, under pressure from Gingrich, Romney released his tax returns, revealing that he had paid an effective tax rate of 14% on income of $21.7 million. It was less than half the rate paid by many middle-class wage earners. Gingrich trounced Romney in South Carolina, winning his first primary and proving that while the American public admired success, it also believed in fairness. By the time the Romney campaign woke up to the threat posed by Gingrich, defeating him soundly in Florida, the damage had already been done. "With those attacks on Bain, he laid down the blueprint for Obama," lamented a conservative in the Koch circle. Foster Freeze, the multimillionaire mutual fund manager from Wyoming and longtime member of the Koch's donor circle, was creating chaos too. As Romney was trying to finish off Gingrich, Freeze was spewing cash into a super PAC promoting Rick Santorum, a former senator from Pennsylvania who shared his zealous Christian conservatism. The nearly $1 million spent by Santorum's super PAC in Iowa vaulted him from footnote status into first place, assuring that his candidacy would continue far beyond its natural political shelf life. Freeze, who seemed to love the spotlight almost as much as Santorum, joined the candidate in making a series of pronouncements about reproductive and gender issues that shocked many women. In the midst of an interview with the NBC correspondent Andrea Mitchell, for instance, Freeze explained why he and Santorum took issue with the contraceptive coverage for women included in Obama's health care plan. "Back in my day, they used Bayer aspirin for contraceptives," joked Freeze. "The gals put it between their knees, and it wasn't that costly." Mitchell, whose professional command was ordinarily unshakable, stammered, "Excuse me? I'm just trying to catch my breath from that, Mr. Freeze, frankly." By the time Santorum and Gingrich bowed out of the presidential race in the late spring, Freeze had contributed $2.1 million and Adelson and his wife over $20 million to the campaigns of their respective favorites. The Democrats were ecstatic at the damage inflicted by the rogue donors. "We were killing them on contraception," says Jim Messina, Obama's campaign manager. "And we were winning on tax issues for the first time since 1996. Steve Schmidt, a Republican political operative, suggests that the shift from broad-based party funding to hugely wealthy outside donors turned the race into an ideologically driven ecosystem. The candidates, he says, were like these football players with their sponsors' names on their jerseys. If you have a single person responsible for your nomination, you owe them everything. You can say not, but it's determinative. Jim Margolis, co-founder of GMMB, the campaign consulting company that worked for Obama's re-election, suggests that Romney would have fared better as a moderate, but his radical backers prevented it. Romney's best strategy would have been to give Obama a golden watch and say basically, "We all had such hope. He tried, but he didn't get it done. I can. I'm Mr. Fix-It. I know how to create jobs." But Romney never successfully did that. Instead, he ran to the right. The Tea Party in 2010 and the donors behind it stirred what Margolis calls this supercharged Republican primary electorate. We didn't know how it would play out, but the likelihood of a moderate, appealing candidate emerging from this? Instead, they had Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich. That was a problem for Romney. As the general campaign got underway, Obama, too, had to worry about rich donors. He had been itching to make economic fairness the center of his presidential campaign, but some of his advisors worried that populism was a dangerous force to play with in an era when both parties were increasingly reliant on hugely wealthy patrons. Obama, though, had sought the presidency in part because he hoped to alter the relationship between powerful financial interests and those who govern. "One of the reasons I ran for president," he had said, "was because I believed so strongly that the voices of everyday Americans, hard-working folks doing everything they can to stay afloat, just weren't being heard over the powerful voices of the special interests in Washington." The Occupy movement had further emboldened him, so he decided to kick off his re-election campaign at the end of 2011 in the tiny town of Osawatomie, Kansas. There, in the place where Theodore Roosevelt had delivered a fiery speech in 1910, demanding that the government be freed from the sinister influence or control of special interests, he tried to tackle the thorny issue of America's growing economic inequality. Obama denounced the breathtaking greed that had led to the housing market's collapse, as well as the Republican Party's you're-on-your-own economics. He also had some stinging words for big money's influence on politics. "Inequality distorts our democracy," he warned. "It gives an outsized voice to the few who can afford high-priced lobbyists and unlimited campaign contributions, and it runs the risk of selling out our democracy to the highest bidder." The words were ringing. The audience cheered. The problem, though, was that no matter how keenly Obama wanted to address economic inequality, he was going to have to turn to his party's own billionaires and multimillionaires for help. Soon, in fact, Obama would set a record for the number of fundraisers attended by an incumbent president. He continued to speak out, even directly to the donors, telling one small gathering of moguls that included Microsoft's co-founder Bill Gates, the richest man in America, "There are five or six people in this room tonight that could simply make a decision. This will be the next president, and probably at least get a nomination if ultimately the person didn't win." And that's not the way things are supposed to work. But like it or not, Obama was, as one top progressive donor, the former head of the Stride Right shoe company, Arnold Hyatt, put it, in a bind. In an early 2012 meeting in the Roosevelt Room, his campaign manager, Jim Messina, shocked the president by sharing the bad news that they now expected outside Republican spending against him to reach $660 million. "How sure are you?" Obama asked. "Very sure," replied Messina. Obama had reserved some of the harshest words of his presidency for the Citizens United ruling, saying that he couldn't think of anything more devastating to the public interest. So he had steadfastly refused to encourage supporters to form an outside super PAC that could accept unlimited contributions on his behalf. "I think we need to switch our position," Messina said. "Until people understand it's important to you, they're not going to give." Soon after, Obama bowed to the new economic reality and reversed himself. His campaign began encouraging supporters to give to the pro-Obama super PAC, Priorities USA. It wasn't the first time Obama had been rendered a hypocrite in order to raise funds. In 2008, after championing campaign finance reform in the Senate, he broke his own pledge to accept public financing as a presidential candidate. Obama admitted that he suffered from the same original sin of all politicians, which is, we've got to raise money. But he insisted that he would fight to reform the system. The argument is not that I'm pristine because I'm swimming in the same muddy water. The argument is that I know it's muddy and I want to clean it up. The extent to which the same moneyed interests tainted both parties, though, became clear after Priorities USA aired its first television ad. It was an emotional tirade from a steel mill worker whose plant was closed down by Bain. He'll give you the same thing he gave us. Nothing. He'll take it all, the worker said of Romney. The Obama campaign then underscored the powerful message from the Super PAC with its own ad, calling Romney a job destroyer and his firm a vampire. At the time, a number of thoughtful economists and academics from both ends of the political spectrum were deeply concerned about the finance industry's impact on the country's growing economic inequality. While high-earning executives, particularly in the finance industry, were prospering, wage earners were stagnating. Experts ranging from former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers to the neoconservative theorist Francis Fukuyama worried that the trend was threatening the middle class and overwhelming the political system. Yet when Obama's ads broached these crucial issues, Wall Street-linked Democrats erupted in anger. Stephen Ratner, who had made millions at the investment bank Lazard Frere and whose wife was the former finance director for the Democratic Party, denounced the ads as unfair. Harold Ford Jr., a former Democratic congressman from Tennessee who had migrated to Wall Street, protested that private equity is a good thing in many, many instances. Cory Booker, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, who was a rising star in the party and who had numerous supporters in the finance industry, went on national television and, to the fury of the White House, said, "This kind of stuff is nauseating to me on both sides." Bill Clinton dealt the final blow. In an interview on CNN, he said, "I don't think we ought to get into the position where we say this is bad work. This is good work." From 2006 until 2009, Chelsea Clinton, the daughter of the former president, worked as an associate at Avenue Capital Group, a $14 billion private equity and hedge fund firm. Mark Lazary, co-founder of Avenue Capital, was a major Clinton supporter as well as a $1 million investor in a fund managed by the Clinton son-in-law, Mark Mavzinski. The Clinton administration had been rife with Wall Street tycoons. Now, as the Obama administration was teeing up Romney's rapacious business record as his key disqualification, Clinton summarily announced that Romney's sterling business career crosses the qualification threshold. At the time, Hillary Clinton reportedly disapproved of her husband's comment, privately saying, "Bill can't do that again." In response, the Obama campaign tailored its message more carefully. For the most part, rather than hammering Romney's wealth directly, it relied on sly symbolism to address the touchy issue of class. "There was too much blowback, so we used cues," said Margolis. "We showed him standing next to Trump's private jet." Regardless of what the donor class thought, the anti-Bain ads proved among the most effective of the campaign. When nervous Obama campaign aides pre-screened the ads in focus groups, "They kept telling us to relax. Stop asking if it's unfair," Margolis recalls. Evidently, the broad public was deeply uneasy about the winner-take-all ethic of corporate America. Yet according to the Princeton University professor of politics, Martin Gillens, because of the outsized influence that the affluent exert over the political process, under most circumstances, the preferences of the vast majority of Americans appear to have essentially no impact. The perception gap between the donor class and the rest of the country was unceremoniously exposed in September when Mother Jones revealed a secret recording made that May by a member of the waitstaff at a high-end fundraiser for Romney. Outrage spread as the public eavesdropped on Romney assuring wealthy supporters gathered for cocktails at a mansion in Boca Raton, Florida, that the votes of 47% of the population weren't of concern to him. Romney's assertion came in response to a question about how he planned to convince everybody you've got to take care of yourself. The subtext seemed to be that the country was rife with freeloaders. My job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them they should take personal responsibility for their lives, Romney replied. There are 47% of the people who will vote for the president no matter what. As he described them, they were people who were dependent upon government, who believe they are victims, who believe government has a responsibility to care for them, who believe they are entitled to health care, food, to housing, you name it. These were people who pay no income tax, he said, and so our message of low taxes doesn't connect. He seemed to be implying that nearly half the country consisted of parasites. This was no slip of the tongue. Romney was expressing what the Wall Street Journal described as the new orthodoxy within the Republican Party. In a new twist on the old conservative argument against government aid for the poor, it denigrated nearly half the country as what the journal called lucky duckies freeloading off the rich. This startling theory held that because many members of the middle class and working poor received targeted tax credits, such as the Earned Income Tax Credit and the Child Tax Credit, which reduced their income taxes to zero, they were a nation of moochers, as the title of a book written by a fellow at the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute put it. Behind the theory were several nonprofit organizations tied to the Kochs and other wealthy ideologues, including the Heritage Foundation and AEI. Foremost, perhaps, was the Tax Foundation, an anti-tax group founded in opposition to Roosevelt's New Deal that had been resurrected by Charles Koch's Cash and directed for some time by Wayne Gable, the president of the Charles Koch Foundation and head of Koch Industries' Washington lobbying operation. As Scott Hodge, president of the Tax Foundation, explained it simply, there were two Americas, the non-payers and the payers. Critics immediately pointed out that the theory ignored the many other taxes paid by lower and middle-income Americans, including sales taxes, payroll taxes, and property and gas taxes, which took a disproportionately large share of their income. The theory also overlooked the unique circumstances of retirees, students, veterans, and the unwillingly unemployed, and it completely ignored the many tax breaks disproportionately enjoyed by the wealthy, from mortgage and charitable deductions to the preferential treatment for unearned income that kept Romney's income taxes at an effective rate of 14%. But the flattering distinction between makers and takers, advanced by conservative think tanks and scholars, had won great favor in wealthy conservative circles. In fact, some conservatives, who opposed virtually every other tax increase, had started calling for new taxes on meager earners, ostensibly for the country's civic good. As Slate's David Weigel cheekily wrote, "Republicans have finally found a group they want to tax. Poor people." The Blackstone billionaire Stephen Schwarzman made this argument 9 months before Romney was caught saying essentially the same thing. When asked in a Bloomberg television interview if, given the dire state of the economy, his own taxes should be raised, Schwarzman, who was one of the most vigorous defenders of the carried interest loophole, suggested that, to the contrary, the poor needed to pay more. "You have to have skin in the game," he said. "The concept that half of the public isn't involved with the income tax system is somewhat odd, and I'm not saying how much people should do, but we should all be part of the system." In addition to its political obtuseness, the comment betrayed complete ignorance of the history of the income tax, which began as a tax only on the 0.1% and was never designed to target the poor. At the time, Schwarzman's comment got little attention. But when the rest of the nation learned from Romney's remarks that the super-rich considered nearly half of them freeloaders, the reaction was explosive. Obama's internal polling numbers, which had hovered steadily in the range of 48% to 50%, shot up to 53% over Romney. The damage was even more pronounced in battleground states, where Romney's numbers plummeted. Within days, polls showed that fully 80% of the country had heard about the remark. More, one pollster said, than knew of the existence of North Korea. The Obama campaign delightedly held its fire while Romney tried to explain but never disavowed it. Finally, after 10 days, Obama's team went on the air with a new television ad slamming the 47% gaffe. It was not the original version the campaign had created. The first version, which never aired, cast Romney's remark against a backdrop of impoverished Americans whose woeful portrait seemed borrowed from Walker Evans or from Robert Kennedy's tour of Appalachia. But in the version that aired, the poor had been banished, replaced by the middle class. The ad now featured female factory workers wearing protective eye gear, a Latino construction worker near a ladder, redolent of upward mobility, and steely-eyed retired veterans in VFW hats. This wasn't just about the poor. By parroting his donors, Romney had cast the election, the mother of all wars, as a fight between a tiny, privileged clique and virtually everyone else. For the most part, the Coctopus was more sensed than seen during the campaign, but 1 month before the election, its elaborate funding mechanism came perilously close to exposure. In California, the Fair Political Practices Commission, the state's campaign ethics watchdog, demanded to know who was behind a suspicious $15 million donation aimed at influencing two controversial California ballot initiatives. One initiative would raise taxes on the wealthy, and the other would curb labor unions from spending money on politics. The donor purported to be an obscure Arizona nonprofit called Americans for Responsible Leadership, but California officials were not convinced this was the whole story. At the 11th hour, they launched an investigation to learn more, because the state's stringent campaign laws required full donor disclosure. Soon, California authorities began to uncover an extraordinary dark money shell game involving many of the same donors, operatives, and front groups associated with the Kochs. Overseeing it was Sean Noble, the Kochs' outside political consultant. His group, the Center to Protect Patient Rights, had passed the money from undisclosed individuals to the obscure Arizona nonprofit, which had sent it on without the donors' names to California. In between, there was a shuffle back and forth to another nonprofit in Arlington, Virginia, Americans for Job Security. As a result, the identities of the original sources of the contributions were masked. Among them was Charles Schwab, the Koch network regular, whose chatty email to Charles Koch surfaced, asking for several million dollars for the California fight and promising to catch up on the golf course after the election. "I've committed an extra $2 million today, making my total commitment $7 million," Schwab wrote. "I must tell you that Sean Noble from your group has been immensely helpful to our efforts." The Kochs, according to one advisor, panicked as California investigators began unraveling Noble's money operation, which was entwined with their own. "They did it wrong, and they thought they had legal liability," he said. Details started emerging, such as a deposition from a California political consultant snared in the investigation, who described how the scheme had begun with some donors who were part of Koch, who wanted to wage an anti-labor fight in California, like the one in Wisconsin. They liked the Koch model, the consultant, Tony Russo, explained, so they suggested that he work with Noble, whom Russo identified as the Koch's outside consultant. After a lengthy investigation, Ann Ravel, the head of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, blasted the daisy chain of front groups as definitely money laundering. The agency eventually imposed a record-breaking $1 million fine to settle the case. It exposed a nationwide scourge of dark money nonprofit networks hiding the identities of their contributors, Ravel said in a public statement that also noted that the groups involved were tied to the Koch Brothers Network. Koch Industries officials leaped in, stressing that the settlement had stipulated that the law-breaking was inadvertent, or at worst, negligent, and that the Kochs had not personally donated money to influence the California ballot initiatives. Further, they argued, Noble was merely an independent contractor. "There is not a Koch network in the sense of we control these groups. I don't understand what that means. Mark Holden, the company's general counsel, told Politico's Vogel, who pointed out that, to the contrary, Charles Koch had referred to our network himself in his invitation to the 2011 donor seminar. Following the embarrassing California investigation, which went on into late 2013, the Kochs began to ease Noble out. By then, Noble, the sunny avatar of small-town America, had left his wife for an office colleague and stirred additional bad publicity by charging almost $24 million for his and his firm's services in 2012. This was more than $1 for every $6 that the Center for Patient Rights spent, according to ProPublica. As the investigation grew in California, the Koch world expertly distanced itself. They've spun it really well, said one of Noble's friends, who spoke on condition that he not be identified, because he, too, feared retribution. They've worked it hard. The truth? The guy who the billionaires hire to direct the money got caught breaking the law. Is he guilty? It's not Sean who is the problem. It's the enterprise. It's an illegal enterprise. In the final stretch of the campaign, it became clear that the presidential race was so close that the outcome would likely depend on voter turnout. Nowhere was this truer than in the state of Ohio, without which Romney couldn't rack up enough electoral votes to win. Here, too, the Kochs and other conservative philanthropists played a little detected role. Controversy about allegations of voter fraud had built to a boiling point all summer. Each side accused the other of dirty tricks, further poisoning and polarizing the political process. The chairman of the Republican National Committee, Reitz Priebus, accused Democrats of standing up for fraud, presumably because ending it would disenfranchise at least two of its core constituencies, the deceased and double voters. Democrats accused Republicans of deliberately reviving racist voter suppression tactics predating the civil rights movement. Bill Clinton declared, "It's the most determined effort to limit the franchise since we got rid of the poll tax and all the other Jim Crow burdens on voting." Impartial experts, meanwhile, like Richard Hassan, a professor of election law at the University of California in Irvine, regarded the allegations of fraud as the real fraud. After searching in vain to find a single case since 1980 when an election outcome could plausibly have turned on voter impersonation fraud, he concluded the problem was a myth. Nonetheless, the alarmism resulted in legislative initiatives aimed at requiring voters to produce official photo IDs in 37 states between 2011 and 2012. It also led to a national outbreak of mysterious citizen watchdog groups calling for crackdowns on election fraud. One such group, the Ohio Voter Integrity Project, policed voter rolls for irregularities and then persuaded local election authorities to send summonses to suspect voters, requiring them to prove their legitimacy at public hearings. Teresa Sharp, a 53-year-old lifelong Democrat from the outskirts of Cincinnati, who received one such summons, discovered at the hearing that the self-appointed watchdog group had mistaken her address for a vacant lot. "My first thought," recalled Sharp, who is African-American, was, "Oh, no, they ain't messing with us poor black folks. Who is challenging my right to vote?" The national outbreak of fear over voter fraud appeared a spontaneous grassroots movement, but beneath the surface there was a money trail that led back to the usual deep-pocketed right-wing donors. To target Sharp, for instance, the Ohio Voter Integrity Project had relied on software supplied by a national nonprofit, True the Vote, which itself was supported in different ways by the Bradley Foundation, the Heritage Foundation, and Americans for Prosperity. True the Vote described itself as a nonprofit organization created by citizens for citizens that aimed to protect the rights of legitimate voters regardless of their political party. But its founder, Catherine Engelbrecht, a Houston Tea Party activist, was guided by Hans von Spakovsky, a Republican lawyer and fellow at the Heritage Foundation, who had made a career of challenging liberal voting rights reforms. Heritage had an ugly history on the issue. The think tank's founder, Paul Weyrich, had openly admitted, "I don't want everybody to vote." In 1980, he told supporters, "As a matter of fact, our leverage in elections quite candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down." Spakovsky's most recent book, Who's Counting?, which was filled with incendiary claims about voter fraud, was published by Encounter Books, a Bradley Foundation grantee, and co-authored by John Fund, another Heritage Foundation fellow. True the Vote, meanwhile, had received Bradley Foundation funds. Americans for Prosperity also gave the organization and the voter fraud issue a boost by featuring both Fund and Engelbrecht at its political events. If the aim was to intimidate voters like Sharp, though, in her case, it backfired. When her name was called at the hearing, Sharp, who was accompanied by six other members of her family, walked to the front, slammed her purse and papers on the table, and asked, "Why are you all harassing me?" Later, she said, "It was like a kangaroo court. There were, like, 94 people being challenged, and my family and I were the only ones contesting it. I looked around. The board members and the stenographer, they were all white people. The lady bringing the challenge, she was white." Sharp concluded, "I think they want to stop as many black people as they can from voting." On election day, to the surprise of Romney and his backers, Democratic voters turned out in far bigger numbers than the Republicans expected. The Koch network had spent an astounding $407 million at a minimum, most of it from invisible donors. The operatives running the enterprise believed they were able to accurately anticipate how the vote would go, and right until the polls closed on November 6th, they, like the Romney team, were convinced victory was at hand. Sean Noble, who was already under a cloud because of the California campaign finance scandal, was so sure of success that on election day, he sent out a memo to the donors telling them that soon the rest of the country would know the good news that they already did, which was that Romney would be the next president. But around 4:30 that afternoon, Frank Luntz called. He said the exit polls didn't look right, but neither Noble nor anyone else among the big donor groups believed it yet. At 11:12 p.m., NBC News called Ohio for Obama, projecting him as the election's winner. When Fox News followed suit, Karl Rove, who was a Fox News analyst as well as the founder of the American Crossroads independent campaign operation, threw a fit on the air. He had talked the rich into contributing $117 million to his super PAC and many, many more millions in dark money, and had confidently assured them of a historic victory. It was premature for Fox to call the race, he insisted. Fox's number crunchers, however, held their ground. Romney had lost. "What happened? We had bad data," a Koch insider conceded after it was over. They had counted on an electorate less diverse than the one that swept Obama into office in 2008. Instead, the 2012 voters were even more diverse. While the proportion of the electorate that was white and old fell, the participation by Hispanic, female, and young voters rose. Black voters, meanwhile, held steady, casting an overwhelming 93% of their votes for Obama. The America that the conservative donors were counting on was out of touch with the reality. In a post-election phone call to his biggest contributors, Romney explained it a little differently. The problem, he said, was that Obama had, in essence, bribed supporters with government services. What the president's campaign did was focus on certain members of his base coalition, give them extraordinary financial gifts from the government, and then work very aggressively to turn them out to vote. Obama chuckled upon hearing of Romney's analysis. "He must have really meant that 47% thing," he told his aides. In Bentonville, Arkansas, a few days later, Senator John McCain's private cell phone interrupted a meeting with Walmart's top executives by mechanically announcing the name of a caller trying to reach him. "Mitt Romney," it squawked. "Mitt Romney." Looking a little startled, McCain fished the phone out of his pocket and answered, rising to leave the room so that he could speak in privacy. When McCain returned, he explained to the curious executives that Romney had wanted advice on how to cope with losing the presidency. "I told him the first time I did it all wrong," McCain related. "My wife talked me into taking a vacation in Tahiti. Worst goddamn mistake I ever made. The second time," he went on, "I just went right back to work. It was fine. I told him, go back to work." The only problem, someone cracked, was that Romney, like those loafers in the 47%, had no job. Commentators leaped to the conclusion that 2012 proved that money had little or no influence on elections. Politico changed the heading for a series it had been running on money and politics from The Billion-Dollar Buy to The Billion-Dollar Bust. With a final tally of approximately $7 billion in traceable spending on the presidential and congressional campaigns, it was the most expensive election in American history by far. One donor alone, Sheldon Adelson, who had vowed to spend as much as it takes, had dumped nearly $150 million, $92 million of which was disclosed, and had still come up short. Approximately $15 million of that had reportedly gone to the Koch's group, Americans for Prosperity. All in all, super PACs and independent groups that could take unlimited contributions had spent a staggering $2.5 billion, and, it seemed, changed nothing. Obama would remain in the White House, the Democrats would continue to dominate the Senate, and Republicans would continue to control the House. Defeat on this scale did not sit well with the Kochs or their donors. "The donors were livid," recalls one advisor. Disappointed, but ever persistent and methodical, Charles Koch sent out an email to his network informing them that the next donor seminar would be postponed from January until April while he and his operatives analyzed what went wrong. "Our goal of advancing a free and prosperous America is even more difficult than we envisioned, but it is essential that we continue rather than abandon this struggle," he wrote. The media's box score approach to politics, however, overlooked the many more subtle ways that money had bought influence. Hugely wealthy radicals on the right hadn't won the White House, but they had altered the nature of American democracy. They had privatized much of the public campaign process and dominated the agenda of one of the country's two major political parties. David Koch, in fact, attended the Republican National Convention as an alternate delegate, a sign of how much the party had changed. Arguably, he had changed, too. At the convention, he gave an interview supporting gay marriage, demonstrating that on this issue he had come far from the day when he had participated in the scheme to blackmail his brother. The Kochs did not, however, put their financial clout behind promoting gay marriage, and David's private view had no visible influence on the party. On a raft of other issues, though, including climate change, tax policy, entitlement spending, and undisclosed campaign contributions, which the Republican Party platform now embraced in a reversal from the past, the preferences of the Kochs and their political partners had prevailed. There was no more talk of strengthening the Clean Air Act, mockery of voodoo economics, support for compassionate conservatism, or expanding Medicare drug coverage as there had been under the Bush presidencies. Government was a force for evil, not public good. Contrary to predictions, the Citizens United decision hadn't triggered a tidal wave of corporate political spending. Instead, it had empowered a few extraordinarily rich individuals with extreme and often self-serving agendas. As the nonpartisan Sunlight Foundation concluded in a post-election analysis, the super-rich had become the country's political gatekeepers. 1/10,000th of America's population, or 1% of the 1%, was shaping the limits of acceptable discourse, one conversation at a time. Obama won, but he had few illusions that he had vanquished big money. "I'm an incumbent president who already had this huge network of support all across the country and millions of donors," he told a few supporters. It had enabled him to, as he put it, match whatever check the Koch brothers want to write. But he warned, "I'm not sure that the next candidate after me is going to be able to compete in that same way." Messina, too, was worried. "I think they erred badly with their strategy," he said, "but I don't think they're going to make the same mistake twice."